In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
With the May primary fast approaching, today's show is a bit of a best of. We here at iSpy Radio believe our previous guests, Sam Carpenter and Greg Wooldridge, are the two best candidates in the Republican primary. Both men are conservatives. Both are strong leaders. Both are turnaround specialists. Sam has helped over 200 companies in Oregon return to profitability. He is the author of a widely respected book, Work the System, The Simple Mechanics of Making More and Working Less. Captain Greg Wooldridge was a three-time commander of the Blue Angels and went on to turn around a failing Navy base to make it the top naval base in the world, like being a CEO of a company with 8,000 employees. These were two different interview styles. With Sam, who'd been in the race for a few months, we got more into policy. With Greg, who had just entered, it was more of a get-to-know-him in his way of thinking. But hearing them back-to-back will give you a good feel for both men. Either of these two men will be a good choice to defeat Kate Brown. They are the kind of a leader Oregon desperately needs before we sink into a California-style black hole. First up, Sam Carpenter. We're talking now to Sam Carpenter. He is a successful businessman and business consultant from Bend. He is now also running for governor as a Republican. Sam, it's good to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
So we just got off the phone with Dr. Bob Zybak talking about natural resources, and I'd like to actually continue some of that discussion with you. But first, I thought we'd get to know you a little bit, especially for members of our audience that may not know a whole lot about you. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about your qualifications and your experience?
Well, I have been in the U.S. Senate race 2 years ago. And so as far as politics goes, I'm an outsider, except for that. And actually, that polls very well compared to being an insider. I have a business in Bend. It's a call center. I have 48 people, and 95% of them are ladies. I've had it, 34 years now. So it's kind of been a really good business for Bend and for me for all these years. And I have written a couple of books. One of them is a business repair manual. It's called Work the System, The Simple Mechanics of Making More and Working Less. And it reflects my experiences with the call center. It's turned out to be a bestseller. It's in its third edition, I think the 12th printing, and it teaches people how to repair their broken businesses. And from that, I've evolved another business that's what we do, is we help people repair their broken businesses. And my partner and I have actually repaired over 500 businesses in the last 7 years, up to $500 million in revenue, but most of them under $10 million in revenue. So I'm very good at fixing broken organizations. And I've got a couple other little things going on, but I am a businessman, and I would like to take my expertise into Salem. We all know that things need to be straightened out over there.
Yeah,
and I feel highly qualified as an outsider to go in there and do that.
Well, I was going to say, certainly with broken organizations, the state of Oregon is a target-rich environment for sure. And things are pretty bad here in Oregon in terms of the atmosphere. To be honest, my wife and I have seriously considered leaving Oregon, and she's a native Oregonian, and there's a part of us that's still considering that. We don't know what that would mean or what that would look like, but there's a big part of us that often wonders if Oregon is beyond repair until it finally hits bottom. I mean, look at California as another great example. So where do you even begin in terms of trying to fix Oregon?
Well, there's a lot of what I'd call low-hanging fruit in the repair part of this. And here's the thing. We could talk about the bridge study, which was $200 million, and the exchange that never happened for $300 million, and this latest CCO debacle. What was that, $150 million? All these horrible mistakes. But what people never talk about, what politicians never talk about, is the everyday dysfunction of the government. And so what my partner and I do is we go into businesses, and I'll tell you in 20 minutes we can figure out what the main problem is. And it usually has to do with systematic stuff, processes, documentation. And sometimes the brother-in-law really does not need to be the sales manager and needs to exit in a small business. There's all kinds of reasons for failure, but the major reason for the government is it's other people spending other people's money. It is incredibly dysfunctional, and nobody talks about that. All we talk about is more taxes to fuel this thing that keeps growing and growing, and the PERS obligation keeps growing and growing. We need to go in there, not with a scalpel, but with a chainsaw. And there's some things we can do to really repair things quickly in there, and that's what I call low-hanging fruit. There's so many things that are so obviously wrong that could be fixed immediately, a lot of them by executive fiat, really. But what we want to do is we want to have a red trifecta, and that is not just to put me in the governor's seat, but to take the House and the Senate and put them back in the control of the Republican Party, and that's doable.
Well, you know, back in the day, and my wife will tell you, is that back in the day, when Oregon was a successful state and the schools had plenty of money, it was an Oregon trifecta. You had Republican governors, you had Republican Senate, and a House. And that's when the state was still running well. So how do you go about bringing together those various groups in Oregon that you're going to need to get behind you? How do you get those groups to coalesce around you?
Well, we always go what I call a layer deeper when we attack a problem in a business. And the layer deeper part is some horrendous mistakes Republicans have been making. Now, one of them is that, oh, this is an oh-so-blue state. Oh, we've got to cross the aisle. No, it's 10% less Republicans than Democrats. It's 38-28. That has been a huge mistake. We're not that far out of the ballpark. Right now, independents, we've done a lot of polling, scientific polling. Independents are going Republican 52-37%. The other big mistake that's made is we don't pay attention to what's happening in the rest of the country. And there are 26 red trifectas, Mark, across the country. There's seven blue. One is California, which almost doesn't count because it's so far in outer space. But Oregon is one, and Hawaii is one, New Jersey is one. There's a couple other very small states back east. The trend has been to Republican control. 26 versus 7, 68% of our governors in this country are Republican. And get this, 68% of our House and Senate legislatures are both red in this country. So we Republicans haven't been paying attention to the rest of the country. We're so convinced this is such a blue state. It's not. And if we'd stop putting forth these cross-the-aisle moderate candidates for statewide office, like, you know, we put Dennis Richardson won his first major win in 30 years, and he stood up on his hind legs and said, look, I'm conservative. I'm going to go in and mechanically fix this thing. And he was elected.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I'm running is kind of a side reason maybe, but I just can't stand to see it will happen again. To go in as a moderate, you know, trying to take care of the other side, make them happy and get some Democrat votes, and lose the base, the whole base, which you need.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll have more with Sam Carpenter. You can visit his website at makeoregongreatagain.com. You can also visit his Facebook page. Just look for Sam Carpenter for Oregon. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking to Sam Carpenter. He is a successful businessman and business consultant from Bend, and he is running for governor as a Republican. And his website, makeoregongreatagain.com, you can find out more about him there, or you can visit his Facebook page, Sam Carpenter for Oregon. And, you know, during the break there, we were talking about some interesting takes that you have in terms of reaching out to Democrats, and especially in terms of not bashing them. You know, we call them stupid and whatnot, and then wonder why they don't vote for Republicans. What are some of your thoughts in terms of how you get Democrats to vote for you?
Well, that's it, and that's one of the other mistakes we Republicans in Oregon have been making is so much of our base, so many of our politicians have just been trashing, if not between the lines directly, doing it directly is calling them names and saying, why can't they be sensible? Why? Come on, you guys, don't you see this is reasonable? They're just idiots. And so we're really referring to the progressive far-left leadership, and actually that is a good description,
yes,
you know, of the far-left leadership, but they don't represent all the Democrat Party.
Yes,
Democratic
Party. I think there are a lot of everyday Democrats out there that are looking for an excuse to vote for a Republican.
Yeah, and if we're calling them names, why should they do that? Yeah, they'll stay home. Mm-hmm. And so we are not going outright praising Democrats. We're just refraining from calling them names.
Well,
I was a Democrat once. I get it.
Well, and I really think that that's how Trump got elected, was he gave enough Democrats reason to vote for him, and that he wasn't this evil Republican. And, of course, you know, the Democrat leadership and the mass media as well tried to point him out, paint him, I mean, as some sort of demonic entity in some ways. But I think those Democrats, you know, they want their businesses to succeed. They want their families to have safety and security. So those are the things that I think that where there's some real commonality there. You stop seeing them as Democrats and you start seeing them as just fellow human beings.
Well, they are. They live next door. They work with us. They're at the Christmas table with us. They're our relatives. They're fine. They're regular people. They're Democrats. We're Republicans. But the far left, you know, they are the problem. I don't mind calling them names because they are the problem. It's not the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So let's talk a little bit about natural resources. That's really the focus of this week's show. In our talk with Dr. Bob, he really laid it out for us in terms of what we ought to be doing. So let's say that you're governor there. What approach would you take to land management?
Okay, land management, it depends which land you're talking about, of course. OMC, federal, you know, being
sure.
The Forest Service and BLM, and state forests. So generally speaking, without getting too far into the politics, a governor of Oregon has a lot of power and a lot of influence. And how much power do I have over what happens on the federal lands? Quite a bit, because I can make a phone call to a guy who will talk to me back east. In the state lands are generally better kept. We could talk about the Elliott Forest, and that's a disaster. But generally speaking, the governor, if the governor knows what he or she is talking about, can throw a lot of weight around. And the problem has been with the politicians, with the exception of Greg Walden, the politicians are afraid to talk about it because they don't know about it. Why is it okay to clear-cut Douglas fir? Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily, as long as you replant it. Do you clear-cut on the east side? No, you don't. You selective cut, generally speaking. How can we clean it up? Why are these forest fires burning? What do we need to do? And what we need to do is mechanically clean it up and go in there and have some reasonable logging operations and talk about sustainability. It's such a far-left term, but it is really true. There's things we can do in the forest mechanically that have to be done. And the governor, depending on the type of land it is, who owns the land, has a lot of influence to go in there and do what needs to be done and get the mechanical job done. And the neat thing is we can clean up these forests. I don't care who owns them. They can be cleaned up, and that job of cleanup can be paid by the thinning and the timber that is taken out. And, you know, the other side thinks you're going to clear cut. You just want to go in and clear cut everything and make it like the moon, which of course is ridiculous. But our kind of lily white Republicans are afraid to talk about harvesting timber because they will be demonized. I will not be, because I've got a background in timber.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I think you're right in the sense that, you know, this is why the federal management is so very different from state management, is because you have people out in Connecticut and New Jersey and Delaware making decisions for us in Oregon, and they have no idea what these forests are like or how big this land is that we're in. They think in very narrow terms because that's their experience. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with the forests.
Well, I ran a survey crew back in the 70s for the U.S. Forest Service over on the Coast Range out of Wedderburn, And before that, I have a technical degree in forestry, which means I'm an on the ground guy, and I can run a chainsaw as good as anybody. But my experience in the forest is hands-on and silviculture related. I can cruise timber, and what I do know is that this non-management of the forest for the last 40 years has caused these problems.
Yes.
It needs to be managed, most of it like a crop.
Absolutely, and that's how I look at it as well. As long as you're replanting it and you're practicing good forest management, it will grow back, and it'll grow back better than ever. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll be talking about some solutions applying a businessman's consulting mindset to Oregon. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is our final segment talking with Sam Carpenter. He is a businessman and business consultant from Bend, running for governor as a Republican. His website, MakeOregonGreatAgain.com, and Sam Carpenter for Oregon is his Facebook page. So let's say that you're governor. What are the first steps to take Oregon?
We need to get into these department heads and get the right people in there. And anybody who doesn't go along with this new methodology, this new agenda, will be removed if I have the power to do that. And these committees, these steering committees, will have to see things my way, particularly if the legislature has been swapped around and from blue to red. That's the very first step. And I am really good at finding people who are experts. Forestry. I have a forestry expert on the west side. I have a forestry expert on the east side. I know how to pick people, and that's a good CEO, able to pick the people who have all the answers. I don't need to have all the answers. I just need to have the people I have confidence in to have the answers, and they talk to me and talk me into stuff or talk me out of stuff, and then I move on to the next thing. It's a huge job. There's a lot of departments, but I'm really good at securing the right people to run the departments.
Farmers and miners, Trump called these guys the forgotten man. And I think in a lot of ways he was very right on that, because they were overlooked by government in terms of, and overlooked in terms of the economy as well. Talk to us a little bit about the disparity between Portland and Eugene versus these rural counties.
Oh, my gosh. The big complaint I hear over and over and over from the outer areas outside the Eugene to Portland corridor is that Salem has forgotten the rural areas. Now, there are 275 towns in rural Oregon of 5,000 population or less. This is the new inner city, devastated by what happened in the early 80s with the stopping of the natural resources, activity, the timber. Anybody from Portland down through Eugene should just drive through the state and pay attention as they drive through these small towns, devastated. And it does go back to what Donald Trump said about offshoring and too many taxes, too many regulations, and too many immigrants coming in and taking the jobs. And so the wages remain low. Here's something, Mark. Cottage Grove had 22 mills in 1978. Average wage, $20 to $25. Take inflation into effect. Those guys, and they were mostly guys back then, should be making $50 to $60 an hour choker setting. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. I forgot. There's no choker setting. There's no logging.
That's right.
So if you can imagine people going out in the woods and making a decent wage, oh, you'd find people to work. And
sure.
In these small towns especially, which I have a place in my belly for these small towns because I'm a small town guy.
Yeah.
This could repair, fixing up the forest could really fix up these small towns as we go in to repair these forests.
I think I had seen a statistic one time that the average wage for the forest industry was $50,000, and that's certainly nothing to sneeze at. Earlier, you had talked about what's happening in the rest of the country with Republicans taking full control in 26 states versus 7 for Democrats. And, I really foresee Oregon being in a world of hurt in the next few years if we don't break the Democrat stronghold on state government. Just this week, it was announced that Apple is looking to repatriate nearly all of its $250 billion it holds overseas. And in so doing, they expect to create 20,000 jobs, build a new campus, and add $350 billion to the economy over 5 years. All of this as a result of the Republican tax cuts. Meanwhile, Oregon continues to try to find new and innovative ways to squeeze more taxes out of its citizens and businesses, you know, the latest being this healthcare tax. What steps would you take as a governor to ride the wave of job creation that we're seeing in other states?
Well, first of all, we have to stop reaching across the aisle in the legislature. And that means we need to own the legislatures. We have spent so much time, and this is a real good answer to your question, Mark, we have spent so much time trying to reason with the other side. We have been so distracted with it. And if we put a Republican governor in there only, it's just going to be a nightmare of catfighting back and forth and back and forth. So the first thing we have to do is get control of the legislature. And then whatever I can do by executive order and is within my purvey, I will do. But we will go right after PERS first thing. And the second thing, okay, tied with the first thing, is this forest problem that we have here. We spent almost $500 million putting fires out in Oregon last year. $500 million, yeah. Most of it federal money. But these are the two things. And then we go rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat down the line. And through the legislature and through whatever I can do personally, we start taking care of these things one by one. One by one, right after the other, until we get the worst 20% out of the way. And then we continue, bam, 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 on down with the legislature and getting this place straightened out. And it's everything. It's not just PERS in the forest. This is a whole lot of other stuff. And it has to do especially with the efficiency of the government on an everyday basis.
Well, you talked about efficiency, and that's certainly something that we've been saying for a long time here on this show. But the other thing that we often looked at is this notion that you get these bad administrators in there or these bad government workers in there, and they never get fired. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Supreme Court's going to punch a big hole in, with this Janus case coming up, into that. And we are kind of stuck with a problem until the problem goes away on a federal level. But there is a lot I can do as a governor, very powerful governor position in this country, to go through and change the management of these departments and start there and work on down.
Unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. Sam, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much, Mark.
You can find out more about Sam at his website, MakeOregonGreatAgain.com, at his Facebook page, or follow him on Twitter, @CarpenterForOregon. All of that is on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com, along with some other links about Sam. Up next, Captain Greg Wooldridge. Today's show is a best of I Spy. We just replayed our interview with Sam Carpenter. Up next, Captain Greg Wooldridge, who is also running for governor. Dr. Tim Ball just won one of his three court cases where he was accused of defaming scientists who want the world to spend $100 trillion or more to possibly lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree, maybe, or at least they hope. You know, it's always nice when good guys win. Speaking of good guys, there's a new candidate in town. I'd like to welcome Captain Greg Wooldridge to the show. He is a former Navy pilot, the only commanding officer to lead the famous Blue Angels team on three separate tours, and he is now running for governor. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mark. I'm glad to be here. This is awesome.
Yeah, you know, it's great to talk to you. You're a former Navy pilot, a commander of the Blue Angels, which are absolutely amazing. Had the chance to see them once up in Hillsborough. Especially considering the precision, not just of the pilots, but the entire crew. You commanded a naval base as well, and you're a motivational speaker on high-performance teams, speaking to audiences about what it takes to lead high-performance teams like the Blue Angels. You've had a tremendous amount of success, and you're out there, retired from the Navy, enjoying the fruits of a life well-lived, and suddenly you decide to run for governor. Was there a tipping point for you? Did something happen, or the governor signed something that made you say, that's it, I have got to do something to turn Oregon around?
Well, I kind of got drafted into this, but I am so pleased that they found me. I was late last summer, a couple of friends of mine who both have served in the Oregon, one in the Senate, one in the House, came to me and said, look, we've got an idea for you that we've floated around the state and it's getting wide applause. And that is that you run for office. And I said, oh, come on, you know, I've never held office before. And they said, no. That's good. No voting record. That's a good thing. And over a couple more of my objections, they said, no, that, you know, we can work, we can make that work. And I thought about it. And I finally, after watching the field and then just watching Kate Brown just continue to do this nonsense and not solve the problems in Oregon. And Oregon's in a tailspin. Let's face it, it's heading for the ground. If we don't get somebody in there to fly that airplane that knows how to run, you know, has the courage and the leadership. And I think that's the big thing that's missing. And I feel like because of my experience in the military, and then even after that, and going around talking to folks and seeing the leaders in these major companies and minor companies and seeing how they lead, all that exposure to that has really put a lot of arrows in my quiver to pull when I need it leading things. And that's what I'm fired up about. And, you know, yeah, like you said, I could have gone on to do some of those other easy things in life, but I've never run from a challenge. I've run two challenges, and that's what I feel here. It's just a challenge. It's an opportunity to take this beautiful state, this great state, and the great people here, and put it at the top of the state's list instead of at the bottom where it ranks in so many areas.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Oregon is doing terribly right now. Unfortunately, our media doesn't always do a good job of covering that. But, you mentioned the field, and we know that you're a conservative. And among your Republican opponents, there are two other conservatives out there. Bruce Cuff, a lot of people are saying he doesn't really appear to be a serious contender, but there is also Sam Carpenter, who also has a background in business. Why did you jump in if there's already two conservatives in the race? And also, why should a conservative support you over these other two?
Yeah, well, I like Bruce and I like Sam. They're good guys. How do I put it? I think I would be a better leader, and I think I can beat Kate Brown, and that's the issue. I can beat Kate Brown, and that's I'll let the competition between us three conservatives go its route. I think people will pick me because I have that drive. I have that passion for the job. I want to build the trust between myself, not only myself, but state government and the electorate and the people of Oregon. They don't trust state government. And that's, you know, I think I have some tools. I have some, you know, I just have the passion to make that happen. And so, you know, you want to separate me from Sam and Bruce? I don't know. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I could, but that's not really what we want to talk about, I don't think. So, I bring it. So,
well, you mentioned trust, and that is such a huge integral part of building successful teams. And I think you're right, is that most people don't trust government. In fact, that's the whole point of the iSpy show, is that we don't trust government. We're keeping an eye on big government. How do you go about getting that trust rebuilt, not only between people and their government, but even within the government itself, between those different agencies?
Right, right. Well, you know, of course, Dennis Richardson, our new, relatively new Secretary of State, is doing an awesome job with the challenge of doing the audits on all the agencies, and he's revealing so much waste. Most of his audits aren't applauded by Governor Brown. They should be. It's cleaning things up. That's where you start building that trust. And should the agency heads be the ones that are, you know, allowing that to happen? Well, then we get new wingmen out there, right? We get a new formation of people that are going to head in the same direction. And now we have trust within the government itself. And once we build that trust within the team, can emanate that out to the public and get the veracity and get their, just go back to that word trust, get them to understand that we are being honest, open, and real with them, transparent, no secret handshakes. And then we build that back. And they've got to know that we're here to serve them, not them to serve us.
You mentioned trust and these audits. I think that is a big key, because what that really boils down to is you're demanding that the government is responsible and that it acts responsibly within its structure, but also certainly on the fiscal side of things. I mean, we see that kind of waste all the time in government.
Right, right. It's if we don't keep on top of it, which Dennis is doing now, if we don't keep on top of it. No, wasn't that Kate Brown's agency for a while?
Yeah.
So, you know, why all of a sudden does this, now these big numbers are popping up. Where were they before?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
Doesn't change overnight. So, you know, I know you only got a minute left, but it's the key. It's the key to getting this thing turned around. And it's millions and millions and billions of dollars. So
Yeah, absolutely.
That money can go back into great, great plans and back to Oregonians if we can.
That's right. The fraud and waste is just astronomical, and you're right. We could be using that so much better. All right, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into his unique background and what his time in the Blue Angels taught him. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking with Greg Wooldridge, a Republican candidate for governor. He is a former Navy pilot and a commander of the world-famous Blue Angels, the only commander who ever led them on three tours. And I'd like to talk about your unique background. In fact, let's actually start there. Why is that unique that someone would lead the Blue Angels on three tours?
Yeah, Mark, it's usually a two-year tour, and then you leave the team. You talk about commanding the team. It's a player-coach type relationship. I'm out in the number one jet in front of the formation. And then when we get on the ground, of course, the whole time I'm responsible for the team. I take full responsibility as a commanding officer. So that's the relationship I had. Now, it's normally a two-year tour, or we call it a tour, and then you go on and go do something else because it's pretty intense. This is something a lot of people don't know. The Blue Angels is just a part of a person's Navy tour or tour duty, their career. So So I did 2 years, and then I went away for about 6 months, and the commander of the team who had taken over from me had to step aside. But I came back for about a year, well, not quite a year, about 8-9 months, and led the team the rest of the time for him, which is unusual. And then about 2.5 years later, the guys on the team stopped wanting to fly with the leader. They were afraid he was going to kill them.
Wow.
So morale was rock bottom, and I was getting ready to retire from the Navy, and I got called from Washington. They said, would you consider coming back? And I said, well, stretch out my retirement date, and sure, I'll do it. With no guarantees, because I hadn't flown in 2.5 years. And I went back, and we got it together and had a very successful season after that. So those are my three times. Occasionally some guys will do it twice in extremis for somebody, but never three times.
Well, I think it must say something about you that your commanders wanted you back for that third time. One of the things that people may not know about the Blue Angels, and I mentioned this in the last segment, is that it's not just these pilots who have to have extreme precision. I mean, you're flying like 3 feet away from your wingman there, and you're flying at 400 miles an hour. But it's the entire team, the ground crew and so on, who all have to be high performers. One little mistake, one little screw not tightened down, and it could be a complete disaster. Talk to us about what it takes to lead a precision team where everything has to go right and everyone has to do their job 100% right 100% of the time.
Right. It goes back to that trust factor. We build that trust. We have a culture of excellence. So culture in any organization is so critical. We said thank you a lot. We shook hands a lot. And one of our catchphrases was glad to be here. Mm. And that reflected that thankfulness, that gratitude to get to work with the people we got to work with. Now, there were six planes in the air that flew, the six of us, and we were flashing around. As George Will would say, there's in any event or any organization, there's the group that are the lightning. You know, they flash around. It could be the sales, people in sales that are out there with the public, but in the background is the thunder. The thunder is the strength of the organization. Mm. The men and women that gave us the airplanes to fly, that filed the files, that swept the floors, no matter what they did, they had ownership in the outcomes of that team, and they felt it, they knew it, and they took pride in that, and it was so cool.
You know, and I think that certainly taps into a lot of what Trump was saying, too, in his successful run, is that it's those people that are so often forgotten. You know, I used to call him the forgotten man, and forgotten right. No longer. But I hear elements of that in what you're saying, is that it's those people behind the scenes that often don't get the credit, but everybody knows they're so critical to how an organization runs.
Well, and that's an important part of leadership. You start from the top. You make that known that you appreciate everybody in your organization. I mean, I would when I go into an office to meet with someone that I'm going to give a presentation to, the person that greets me, I learn their name. I share thoughts with them because I know how important their job is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to, and sometimes you could say the first person you see in an outfit is the VP of first impressions. So
You know, and so it's very important to recognize that everybody has a major role in the success of the enterprise. So,
well, I know that because we in my MBA days and also in my doctorate level, we studied high performance teams. And that mm-hmm. is something that always kind of mystified me, where so much attention is put on the C-suite, where you've got, you know, the CEOs mm-hmm. and the chief financials and, you know, the C's and the various acronyms. But so right. little attention is given to the front men, as you say. And it's often a shame to me that so many companies invest so much in those upper-level managers in terms of time and development and everything else. But then it's those people, like you say, that make the first impression that don't get paid as much as they ought to be, that get overlooked, that don't get the trainings, that don't get everything else. And a lot of times it's a thankless job, and yet it is so critical to that organization's success. So how do you then start translating that into efficiency within government?
That's a good one. Again, you have to give people expectations. Hmm. If you don't outline
yes.
clear
yep.
and bold expectations, people are going to wander. They're going to wander. I call it in my training, having a center point. People need to have a center point well-defined with how you expect them to get it done. And then you give them feedback. You know, you can let them just flounder along and not be doing the right job, but you've got to give feedback. You can expect what you inspect, kind of is the thing. And to get the inefficiencies out of government, you just start from the top down, and you build those expectations and work on it. So it can be done.
Yeah, and then hold them responsible for not meeting those expectations. All right, exactly. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Greg Wooldridge. He is a Republican candidate for governor. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now on the I Spy Radio Show, talking with Greg Wooldridge. He is running for the Republican nomination for the governor of Oregon. This has been a get-to-know-you kind of interview, and then we'll have him back a little bit later on to talk about policy a little bit more in depth. And in case you're just joining us, he is a retired Navy captain and former commander of the Navy Blue Angels. See, I should mention that you weren't just the commander of that's a minor accomplishment. You weren't just the commander of the Navy Blue Angels, but you were a commander of a naval base as well.
That was... You know what? Everybody says, boy, leading the Blue Angels must have been the pinnacle of your career. Actually, being able to build a team and lead that base, the biggest Navy jet base in the country, a fantastic place, but out in the middle of the cotton fields of Central California, but a great place to raise kids and do flight operations, which was our charter. But it was like a small state. It had everything. It had airport with two 13,500-foot runways. We had hospitals. We had stores. We had schools. We had public safety, you know, security, everything you could imagine in a state. And I had such a great team, yet the responsibility came back to me. Whenever things went wrong, it was right on me, and that's fine. And I accepted that, and I thrived on that. Going after making things work right and being open and answerable.
Well, and responsibility is just something you don't hear very often when it comes to government workers or government anything. We hear about $300 million wasted on a study to determine whether or not we need a bridge crossing the Columbia.
Right.
Billions of dollars are wasted every year on various programs. I know that, you know, one of our big bugaboos when it comes to the environment is the amount of waste on global warming studies. Fiscal year 2014, the Obama White House spent $22.2 billion on global warming initiatives over the possibility that maybe if we do everything that they say over the next 50 years, we might lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree. It's just an astonishing amount of the waste there, and that there just never seems to be any responsibility. In terms of actually firing people from government, where do you stand on that? How do you get them? How do you end up firing them when there are so many protections to keep them there?
All right. Well, that's a good question. But if you can absolutely prove that there's negligence, then they have to go. I'm a believer in second chances when that's allowable, you know, because sometimes you can engender incredible loyalty if you can give somebody a second chance. If
sure,
they haven't done
absolutely.
Something intentionally, maliciously, or, you know, totally out of the realm of acceptance. However, if you've got people in positions of authority and they are willfully or knowingly doing something that isn't along the goals or in the line with the goals of the organization, you have to be able to fire them. And we'll fight to do that. When that comes up in the state, we will fight to do that. And I know there'll be those that'll try to protect them, but we'll work with the unions and other folks, and we'll show people that it's best for the state. And, you know, you have to be a shepherd of the state's money and make sure that people are getting their money's worth.
Absolutely. We've talked about efficiency on a number of levels. Just looking at the government in rather broad terms right now, are there areas in particular that you see as especially wasteful?
Well, I think one of Dennis Richardson's finds about Medicaid was the 14% of the folks that got services that weren't entitled to them, to the tune of $72 million. And then there's another, 70% that we're not sure that haven't responded, that we haven't made that determination yet. That's a big area where we can cut back waste. And there are several more that just need to be looked at real closely. But big numbers, millions.
Oh, absolutely.
Hundreds of millions.
Yeah, hundreds of millions. I know within the Oregon Health Authority, there's a tremendous amount of waste. And now, of course, with that new health care tax, as we discussed last week, that new health care tax that we just put in, they're already looking to divert some of those funds into things that they had said they would never do and never mentioned when they got that passed as well. In the minute and a half or 2 minutes or so that we've got here with you, I'd like to return to something. You use this simple phrase, glad to be here, as part of your efforts to get more efficiency out of people. And that's deceptively simple, I think, especially when you look at government and how many people in government actually say that. I mean, that they're glad to be here. I know that when I've gone into government buildings, a lot of them seem this is almost like torture for them to be here. I just think if you could get people within government to really have that notion of being glad to be here, that alone would raise a lot of efficiency right there.
It has to start at the top. You know, yes. You have to reject that your gratitude for having the people that are around you. And once you do that and it filters down along with that glad to be here, because you have a gratitude and a thank you for them being with you and helping you and doing the right job, it builds that culture, it builds that mindset. But along with that comes respect. So you respect the people that you're glad to be with. And when that respect filters down, that also builds a sense of oneness and team and ownership. And that's what we're looking for. We want people to feel like they own outcomes. When the outcomes are good, that's strong. When they're fair, let's work on getting it better. We can do better. You know, we can make this happen. Let's take a look. How are we going to do this? You know, so it is. It's a great motto. It just has real deep meaning.
So it's January 2019. You're governor. What needs to be fixed in Oregon first, you think?
My top three are education, infrastructure, getting those roads built, getting those 72 failing bridges rebuilt, and opening up lanes of commerce. If we can't get the commerce moving and moving fast, we're not going to build the tax base up by encouraging people to be here. Education, I'll go back to that. We've got to do better with our young people. I mean, they are failing and leaving school. And then PERS, we got to take a close look at PERS and get that fixed. I got some great ideas on doing that with a couple of real brains that I'm going to pull in. So those are my first three, and we're going to get after it.
Those are certainly big chunks to take out. And if you can accomplish those in your first term, that would be awesome. Greg Wooldridge, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We'll definitely have to have you back.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here anytime.
You can find out more about Captain Greg Wooldridge at his website, wooldridgefororegon.com, at his Facebook page, or follow him on Twitter at Greg Wooldridge. And if you missed any of that, it's all on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com, along with some other links about Greg, and Sam's information is there too. Let us know what you think. Who's your guy? And be sure to vote, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.